Hello, everybody. This is Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 48. And we have completed, we are on page 103, and we are talking about the different ways that an individual proceeds around the wheel of rebirth. So there are two major ways of proceeding, and according to the way which the astrologer determines is correct for an individual, so will the horoscope be cast, or at least so will it be interpreted at first, and later, when we know more about casting the horoscope of the soul, so will it be cast. So our questions here: is the subject a personality progressing around and around the wheel that gives you the idea of the millions of years that it requires to go around the wheel of rebirth until some spiritual point is reached, going around and around the wheel, perfecting self-consciousness, and developing a rounded-out personality? So the influence of the sun is very important, because that is, in a way, the symbol of self-consciousness. And the fullness of the sun, the rounded out personality, through experience and the working of the law of karma under Saturn, subject to the great illusion, subject to the moon in a sense, and subject to the great illusion, and arriving eventually at the height of personality ambition in Capricorn. So is that the way the individual is proceeding clockwise? And let us say, according to the sun sign, developing the three personality elementals and their union as the selfishly integrated personality, expressing through Capricorn, or is the individual not on the wheel of form but on the wheel of consciousness and at least beginning to manifest as a soul, pouring light through the dense fogs of illusion which can be found upon the cosmic physical plane, the three lower levels, and preparing for the major tests in Scorpio at the first, second, and third initiation, to be followed by, finally, initiation in Capricorn. And by initiation, in this case, is meant the third initiation. Let us say that both Scorpio and Capricorn are involved in the third initiation. Actually, you know, it really is possible for people to take initiation in and under many signs. They have a full opportunity if they are ready. And ingresses, the change of a sign of a progressing planet, such as the sun or such as the ascendant, well, they really shouldn't be called planets, but those changes of the major points, the changes of the angles, give new energy to which the individual can respond, and in relation to which he or she can take initiation. So initiation in this case is really the first of the solar initiations, that is the third initiation. The preeminent test in Scorpio is found in relation to the astral body in the second initiation, but Scorpio is also active at the first degree and active at the third degree, which with a peculiar testing influence, which then ceases at the third degree, and perhaps Scorpio can be applied in a different way, contributing to the death of the causal body at the fourth initiation, because we're told that Scorpio stages the release of Leo. The ultimate release of Leo is the release from Ahamkara through the destruction of the body of individuality, the supra-personality, the causal body, the egoic body. Subsidiary questions then would be, for instance, for which death is the man preparing? Well, we had the death in relation to drowning of Pisces, the death in relation to fire of Aries, the death in relation to suffocation of Scorpio. We had no death by air. So for which change of state, change of dimension, for which relinquishment is the man preparing? What type of experience is he willing to give up in the great and general process of detachment? Is there an imminent crisis at hand which indicates a birth into some new state of consciousness? Well, signs of crisis, you know. We have listed the signs of crisis, the crisis of the burning ground, let's see, what do we have? The crisis in Virgo, the crisis of the birth hour. We have the, the crisis of the battlefield. And if we look at Esoteric Astrology page 472, we see all these different crises listed, which are good to have in mind. And these are the crises of the souls. We have the crisis of incarnation under Cancer, crisis of orientation or reorientation under Aries, crisis of initiation under Capricorn, crisis of renunciation under Gemini, that's interesting, related to crucifixion, crisis of the battlefield under Scorpio, that's already been listed, crisis of the birthplace under Virgo, that's been listed, crisis of the burning ground, that is the final burning ground before the fifth initiation, I would expect, and that is under Leo. So Leo, Libra, and Capricorn are signs of crisis. Let's look this up. Just test this. Signs, crisis. Let's see what it says here. Paramount signs of influence. Let's see. And 12 signs. Okay, marks points of crisis. From this group of signs. Yes, and their attendant constellations, three are omitted because we have a previous grouping of nine signs, and some have been omitted, and they are called signs of crisis. These three signs are all signs of crisis and indicate progressive influence of the other nine and the situations which evolve out of their activity. They are testing points in the play, in the process of the play of energies from the other nine signs. And these are Leo, the crisis of individualization, Libra, the crisis of balance, and Capricorn, the crisis of initiation. So let's add to page 472, page 265 from the same book, and we can call this indicate the birth of some new state of consciousness, and let's say pages on which the different crises are listed. I'm having a moment of, page 472 and 265. The crises are listed, as well as the several crises which are listed before in the book, pages that we are now studying. Yeah, here they are. The crisis of the battlefield in Scorpio, the crisis of the birthplace in Virgo, and the crisis of the burning ground, which is related to Uranus. Okay. And that's also related to Leo, and Leo is very powerfully related to Uranus because Uranus is the veiled hierarchical ruler. So, as esotericists in training, we are always looking out for crisis. Crisis is that through which we should be passing. The personality doesn't really want to pass through it, but we should be passing through this. And this will give the consciousness the opportunity to liberate itself from normal conditions. Okay, is there an imminent crisis at hand? Well, usually in your horoscope, when Saturn is becoming powerful, when Pluto is getting into aspect, when Uranus is crossing the angles or some other important point or aspecting some important point, we can expect some sort of crisis which forces, like a good square does, an astrological square, it forces decision upon us, oftentimes very hard decisions. So is there an imminent crisis at hand which indicates a birth into some new state of consciousness? So here is the key that crisis offers, a birth opportunity. Usually people think of it as the end, you know, some sort of death. Well, it is a death in a way, but every birth is a death. So the crucial question, however, to be determined in every case is the direction in which the man is progressing around the wheel of life. What is the direction? And basically what that means is, in what way is the man responding to the different signs, constellations, which may be influential in his life? Is he responding as an elemental being, a personality, or is he responding as the soul in incarnation, gradually becoming consciously the soul on its own plane? And a lot of people are, you know, sort of in between. But even if they are in between and are beginning to progress towards the realization of that higher power, the esoteric rulers can be used because the man is, in fact, reorienting himself. It is when reorientation occurs that the esoteric rulers can be used. Let's see, we saw this earlier. And do we find it here? Well, perhaps not. It is here, and we did discuss it, that when there is reorientation, the reversal of the wheel does occur, and it is possible to use a higher ruler. At least the beginning of the process of the reversal of the wheel occurs, one can use a higher ruler. The important thing is not to apply these higher rulers to ordinary personal circumstances. So, what is the direction in which the man is progressing around the wheel of life? And let us all hope that those who are serious students of this treatise are progressing counterclockwise. We should be progressing counterclockwise. The orthodox horoscope concerns the personality life, and the form is bound upon the wheel of life as it turns from right to left. So let's see, from right to left, and that means from Aries to Taurus via Pisces. So this is the clockwise direction. Of course, we can, you know, debate whether this really looks like right to left, but this is the way DK defines it. It turns, in a way, into matter. Left, the direction left indicates matter. The direction left indicates matter and personality. But the soul is bound to the wheel as it turns from left to right, out of form, matter, personality, into soul, spirit, going from Aries to Pisces, the counterclockwise direction, via Taurus. And this is very important. It is this antagonistic movement of the wheel turning upon itself, as it is expressed in the Bible, which leads to the conflict carried out in the individual life. Yes, very important, because for so many of us, the wheel is turning in two directions simultaneously, and we have not yet finally reversed the wheel so that we do not feel the friction of the turning towards the left, while we, in our consciousness, are attempting to turn towards the right. So we have a mixed method of responding to the various signs. Sometimes we respond in a personal manner, and sometimes we respond in a manner which is of the soul and aligns us with the soul purpose and plan. So we are in the midst of a rending process, which creates friction, creates fire, creates a kind of burning ground. The more intent we are deliberately to move from left to right, symbolically, the more we instigate this burning ground, this friction, this contrary movement against the natural elemental tendency of things. So there is the wheel turning upon itself. This sometimes indicates the fourth dimensional rotation of the chakra, but DK is applying it to the zodiacal wheel, and perhaps the zodiacal wheel of constellations does, in a way, turn upon itself, and there will come a day when, at least etherically or in terms of the subjective planes, we do have a wheel of fire, and even the zodiac itself will turn fourth dimensional. This would be equivalent to a fourth dimensional rotation of the heart in the head center, because the zodiac is, as we have been stating, the heart and the head of that great deity we call the one about whom naught may be said. Okay. It is this antagonistic movement of the wheel turning upon itself, as it expressed in the Bible, which leads to the conflict carried on in the individual life. And all of us know of these conflicts between the pairs of opposites, between right and wrong, between higher and lower, between spiritual and material, between the demands of the personality and the demands of the soul, between fragmentation and unity, between separativeness and union. The wheel turning upon itself is the condition of many of us. It's not fully turning upon itself. It's not fully a globe of fire or turning in all directions simultaneously, not yet. But for most of us, we are going against the natural elemental grain, and we are swimming upstream, and we are aware that there is a current facing us which would sweep us back into elemental life unless we really exert ourselves, as we will under Mars. Leads to the conflict carried on in the individual life. In the life of humanity, yes, because humanity also is becoming the world disciple and trying to move forward against the elemental order of things, and the life of the planet as well. The soul of the planet is turning against the tendency of the planetary entity, which is the life of the lower three vehicles, the life of the very lowest planes of the planetary logos, what we call the three lower worlds or the 18 lower subplanes. So, you know, our life will be one of strain and cross currents, and if we deliberately decide to move forward, it will be as if we are on a cross, and as if we are experiencing many squares and oppositions from cross currents and counter currents. This is actually promoting crisis, and it is a good thing, because definitely difficulties will appear when we set our will, our determination, our effort to move towards the expression of the soul. We will invoke crisis. We will experience the friction of running counter to the elemental order of things. We will find ourselves against the elements, as it were. In the early stages of evolution and upon the mutable cross, the consciousness is entirely identified with life in form. It doesn't know there's anything else. It just thinks this is it, only this is it. And with the life of self-consciousness, ahamkara, self-preservation, and self-enrichment, these are all the early tendencies of the soul in incarnation to misidentify itself with the objects of its perception. So that self-consciousness, we call that ahamkara. Self-preservation is one of the major instinctual drives. Self-enrichment is, let's call it self-aggrandizement. Because when you think you are a particular center, you seek to increase the scope and power of that center, so you grasp to yourself that which will enlarge or inflate that center. So you are, in a way, nurturing the very center of your consciousness. You're nurturing your lower ego. And this is life upon the mutable cross, and people who are found in that very egoistic stage, they are recognizable. They don't think there's anything wrong with simply enlarging, aggrandizing, enriching the illusory self. They don't know it's illusory. But other people are divided, and they have conflicts about what is good and what is bad, and what is for the unity and what is for the separate self. And they have their eyes on their separate self sometimes, but they have their eyes on the soul at other times. Okay, so that's kind of a Leo ahamkaric phase. Then comes an interlude. When you ever see the word interlude, just suspect the sign Libra, that is, in a way, the lord of the interludes. Then comes an interlude wherein the consciousness begins to shift into that of the group. The lower hemisphere of astrological signs gives way to the upper hemisphere, beginning with Libra, suggesting group consciousness, and becomes identified with the soul and with soul purpose. Eventually, one becomes not just the man for himself, but ultimately the man for others, of which the Christ is the great example, living a life for others, and realizing, of course, that the others are oneself. This realization is sometimes realized under Gemini, sometimes under Libra. There is this sense, Pythagoras talked about it, what is a friend? A friend is another self. So there is the recognition of the higher self, but there's the recognition of the other self equal to oneself on the horizontal plane, and the self that one is no longer is the very center of attention, but one feels into the other self, the self of others, as if it was their own self. Ultimately, it is one self, one feeling of being, if you will. I've sometimes questioned myself as what is selfhood? And it is this intuitive registration of being. It doesn't have to be a limited thing. It can be an unlimited, infinite thing. It's still a self, at least in the words of the ancient Hindus. But there are other Buddhists that deny, of course, the existence of self. I think it's just a question of how we define our terms. So then comes this interlude. You know, we're on the mutable cross, we're very much an egoic self, in the lower sense. We're following the instinctual life. Form is very real to us, there are no other alternatives. Then comes the interlude when some inner registration or influence is received. And the higher of the pairs of opposites comes into the field of consciousness, and we begin to call it by various names, including that of the soul, and we begin to realize that it has a purpose which is different from the purpose we had been following when we were thoroughly identified with form. The experience of the fixed cross covers this period, this shifting of consciousness into the group. Okay, the fixed cross covers the experience of shifting individual consciousness into group consciousness. It might here be noted that the experience of the three crosses has a Masonic significance and can be connected with the Blue Lodge. The Blue Lodge, in a way, is a reflection. It represents the first 3 degrees of Masonry, and some extend it to consider the first 5 degrees, borrowing some degrees from the York Rite, the so-called Christian Rite, R-I-T-E. You know, Masonry is very, very important. In the AUM Masonry, Ancient Universal Mysteries, which is an attempt to reformulate Masonry on an entirely higher and more spiritual standard, undertaken by the AUM Lodge with Brother Keith Bailey as the Venerable Master, the Chief Principal Officer of that lodge. We have a real movement towards the new Masonry, so I would strongly recommend that those of you who have an interest in what Masonry can bring to you and to humanity, you investigate the AUM Lodge and contact Keith, Brother Bailey, contact him and see what is possible with affiliation with that very considerable movement, a movement which is a continuation of that which Alice Bailey and her associates attempted in the 1930s with the help of Foster Bailey and certainly with the support of the Tibetan master who wrote The Lost, The Spirit of Free Masonry under Foster Bailey's name, and Alice Bailey took it down. Foster Bailey gave his name for the publishing, and the Tibetan is really the author. So if we want to understand what the rites of initiation are all about, Masonry is the way to do it. one of the great ways of doing it, anyway, a way which is often for the training of first-rate people, the training of the will, but using a seventh-ray form and with a fourth-ray purpose. The Common Cross then represents the EA degree. Everybody knows what these things mean, the Entered Apprentice degree. The Entered Apprentice degree in relation to Sirius is the fifth initiation, but it's the first initiation which finally, for man, represents the Entered Apprentice degree. You're just learning about the ways of the soul. So for a long time you have to struggle on the Common Cross, really for millions and millions of years. For the, let's just say, as I have sometimes said, suppose it takes 25 million years to make a master. It's not an unreasonable figure, and the number 25 is can be connected with humanity and with mastership. Then just, you know, so many millions of those years, even into the 20s, are dealing with the Common Cross. The Fixed Cross is the FC Fellowcraft degree. The mind is being trained. Remember what happens at the second initiation. You develop the spiritual intelligence and the illumined mind. So education becomes of the utmost importance, and so does group fellowship and relation. We begin to realize we are not living unto ourselves alone, but we are progressing with the group. And then the Cardinal Cross indicates the Master Mason degree. That's the third degree. You know, sometimes this term has been borrowed to represent the kind of grilling or examination that someone under suspicion may get. We gave him the third degree, meaning we questioned him mercilessly under the heated lamp, you know, till he began to sweat and finally admitted the truth. But this idea of going deeply and into one's consciousness and life and dying and being resurrected, all of this is contained in the Master Mason degree, and there are other degrees to be interspersed here. One before the Master Mason degree, which is called the Mark degree, and another after the Master Mason degree, which is the HRA degree. It's a final sublime degree. Five degrees leading, representing five initiations, and telling the story of the birth of the Christ and its cultivation and its testing and its apparent defeat at the hands of the elemental life and its resurrection unto freedom. So it's amazing how much DK has sprinkled the discussion of Masonry throughout his works. He considered it very important for the training of humanity in the Aquarian Age, just the way the new church will be very important, and just the way the banded esoteric organisms will be very important. Masonry, archetypally at least, training those upon the first ray, the church training those upon the second ray, and the banded esoteric organisms training those upon the third ray. And I think when I mention these rays, I mean the general monadic ray. Much will come to light in Masonry when its astrological implications are studied and understood. And DK does give these. He gives important astrological relations to Masonry. In the conventional Masonry, maybe none of this is much known. In the new AUM reformulation of Masonry, the formulators, Brother Bailey and the masters of the various lodges, are astrologically aware and are bringing these astrological points forward. So much will come to light in Masonry when its astrological implications are studied and understood. Much will also be revealed anent individual life and purpose when the fate of certain planets, the fate, the tendency, the influence, the fate of certain planets, when in various zodiacal signs, is properly investigated and grasped, and their symbolic influence is interpreted. And he does, although DK tends not to give us the conventional astrological reading, whereby a planet in a sign means this, he does occasionally talk about such things, what Mars and Scorpio could represent, what Venus in Cancer could represent, what Saturn in Libra could represent. He doesn't go through the entire gamut of every planet and every sign, but he does give us the hint as how we can do this. So we do want to reveal individual life and purpose. There's nothing quite so dreadful as living a purposeless life, and of course there's something equally dreadful as knowing your purpose and not being able to fulfill it, or not managing to at least be on the right track to fulfill it. So this greatest and oldest of all the sciences in its esoteric aspect wants to make of us happier people who recognize our purpose and have a plan or a program for the fulfillment of that purpose, and can use astrology to help us understand step by step how we might fulfill that deep soul purpose, and eventually even a deeper monadic purpose. For instance, it is well known theoretically and mathematically that, one, the sun is exalted in Aries. Yes, I think there are some mathematical derivations for the exaltations of the various planets, and they do occur in specific degrees. I could look that up at the moment, you know, which particular degrees, but, you know, just running down the list, the sun is exalted in Aries, the moon is exalted in Taurus. Mercury is, DK says, exalted in Virgo, though normally we're not given an exaltation position for it. Venus is exalted in Pisces. The Earth is not given an exaltation position, but it is the hierarchical ruler of Gemini, but that's not the same as exaltation. Mars is exalted in Capricorn. Jupiter is exalted in Cancer. See, the pairs seem to go opposite each other. The Venus, the Mercury-Venus pair, for instance, we have Virgo and Pisces, opposites. The Mars and Jupiter pair, we have Capricorn and Cancer, opposites. Uranus is exalted in Scorpio, and Saturn is exalted in Libra, and Uranus in Scorpio, so we don't have a pair there. Neptune is considered to be exalted in Cancer, but there is also a special relationship of Neptune in Pisces, a very high spiritual relationship, which DK tells us Alan Leo intuited. And let's see, yes, mostly, yes, Cancer and Pisces, but he says there's a special type of exaltation of both Jupiter and Neptune in the sign Cancer, which normally would be considered the sign of their fall, where they would come under detriment. Well, their expression could be hampered in some ways initially, but later in Capricorn, a very high form of psychism could occur for Neptune, and a high achievement of consciousness for Jupiter, and so forth. When it comes to, I said Uranus and Scorpio, when it comes to Pluto, we don't really have a place for its exaltation, but we have a, maybe in Aries, I'm not sure, we have a rulership of a kind, both in Scorpio and definitely in Pisces. So exaltation is a very special type of expression. I think it's even a higher type of expression than rulership, in a way. When we come to Libra, we have Saturn not only exalted in Libra, but the hierarchical ruler. So we see a tremendous emphasis upon Saturn in this sign of justice and equilibrium, Libra. So, here the sun, the exaltation, here the sun stands for the life of spirit, which comes into full expression as the result of the great evolutionary process. So finally, at the end of it all, the life of spirit, maybe on the logoic plane at the seventh initiation, shines forth. Aries initiated the great evolutionary process, probably from the will aspect of the monad, and also from the soul on its own plane, descending into the lower three worlds. And finally, there is a great consummation after seven initiations where the spirit in the sea of fire blazes forth, and the monadic vehicle itself from the sixth plane is destroyed or compromised, or at least not considered an obstacle or a containment. The life of God, which in this sign is swung into activity, notice Aries and the life, eventually achieves consummation, consummation here is not the usual fourth degree consummation or even mastership, but that which lies beyond, on the plane of life, on the logoic plane, there is a consummation. And that is the real resurrection, the seventh degree connected with Aries and the exaltation of the sun. Latency becomes potency, and midnight emerges into midday. Now, sometimes midnight is a very high thing, you know. There is an initiation at the midnight sun, so to speak. But sometimes midnight is darkness and obscurity, and it comes into the full light of day, the high noon of midday. God the Father rules. When finally does God the Father rule? Well, you know, not even for a master does God the Father completely rule. And for a liberated Chohan of the sixth degree, is God the Father ruling? Well, one is a member of Shambhala, and in a way God the Father rules. But how much more so for a Chohan of the seventh degree, who, like the Christ or the Buddha, is focused upon the highest of the etheric subplanes, the logoic plane. There, indeed, God the Father rules. Okay. Let's go on. We're talking about exaltations. We're talking about certain falls and detriments and empowerments. Exaltation is a great empowerment of that which the planet represents. A detriment is a weakening. A fall is a severe weakening. A rulership is a compatibility or a harmonious expression of the Lord of the planet in relation to the Lord of the sign. The power of Venus is lessened in this sign, because Venus rules in Libra, and then all you have to do is go to the opposite sign and find where the detriment or the lessening of power occurs. The opposite sign of Libra is Aries, and that's where the detriment occurs. It is detrimental, a detrimental sign to Venus. Now, yes, in a way, I mean, you can get good out of any planet in any sign. And oftentimes, since the opposites can be turned, detriments are like rulerships. Detriments can be made harmonious, and falls can be rendered into exaltations. For instance, you know, think of this. The moon is exalted in Taurus. Is that necessarily a good thing? The mother of the form may become so dominant that the exaltation represents a compromising of the spirit. Then the moon is said to fall in Scorpio. Well, is that such a bad thing? Yes, it's uncomfortable for the personality elementals and the personality as a whole. It is uncomfortable. But the lunar tendencies are then defeated. The moon falls away. And the higher life is no longer obscured by these lunar tendencies and by the ancient patterns. So is that a fall necessarily bad? So exaltations are not necessarily good, and falls are not necessarily bad. We're told about how Mars is exalted in Capricorn. You think that's a wonderful thing? Well, maybe for an advancing individual it is a wonderful thing, but what about for a warlike, selfish, greedy individual? It would be constant warfare for the sake of the lower ego, and people would be playing King of the Mountain all the time and knocking others off of these pedestals because they themselves seek power over others, Mars and Capricorn. So is the exaltation necessarily a good thing? What about Mars and Cancer? It's a fall, isn't it? Well, you know, it is a source of irritation for the individual. It can lead to solar plexus activity, excessive, and it can lead to a defensiveness and a kind of a fear and wariness, but it also is a tremendous ability to reduce the power of Mars so that as the symbolizing the united personality elemental, it no longer gets in the way. And it can be a great effort of the personality aspirationally to rise out of its own lower nature. So, you know, in a Geminian manner, you have to look at everything from both angles simultaneously, and there's no absolute statement. You know, the sun falls, you know, the sun is exalted in Aries. Well, what if that, so that's great, right? But what if that sun represents the Ahamkara principle? And there is a complete type of selfish identification with one's own lower ego and the tendency to force everyone else in one's own way. One becomes the exalted son in the middle of everybody else, and there is no consideration of the other. Is that a good thing? So always look at things from both perspectives, that the high can be low and the low can be high, depending on the perspective. So why is the power of Venus lessened in this sign? The reason is that when the sun is exalted and blazes forth in all its glory, which is the, let's just say, the father aspect, a father aspect blazes forth, spirit, life, etc. The other lesser luminaries, those close to the sun like Mercury and Venus, fade out. So Venus is a luminary as far as the Earth is concerned. It's the Venus is the brightest planet, relatively. It's not absolutely the brightest planet, but relatively it is so for us Earth beings. And as a solar angel, it represents the solar angel. The solar angel fades out when the monad comes into full power. So let's see what he says. Just as the personality is lost sight of in the light of the soul, the solar angel. So the moon fades out in the light of the of Venus, let us say. A moon-Venus conjunction will give us the opportunity to allow the moon to fade and Venus to rise. So the soul itself disappears at the fourth initiation, and its power and radiance fade out, returning to the heart of the sun, or the central spiritual sun, when the presence, i.e. the monad, which it has hitherto veiled as the angel of the presence, the solar angel is the angel of the presence, it's veiled the presence, appears and dominates the scene at the end of the greater world cycle. So what do we have here? We have the monad in ascendancy. And so Venus, which is the solar angel, which is a very bright light, and certainly a very bright light when compared to the light of the personality, is found to be a lesser light. So we have some rules in the 14 rules, advanced rules for disciples and initiates, which point to this rule 5 and rule number 9. And I will turn to these just here. And let us see what we have. I think we will see this. Rule number 5 goes like this. In unison, let the group perceive the triad shining forth. The triad is the expression of the monad, dimming the light of the soul and blotting out the light of form. So the middle light, the light of the sun, S-O-N, is blotted out in the light of the Father, which the triad represents, dimming the light of the soul and blotting out the light of form, because we're seeing in wholeness now, which is the prerogative of the monad or the Father aspect. When we turn here to rule number 9, also important, let the group know there are no other selves, not even soul selves. Let the group know there is no color, only light, and then let darkness take the place of light, hiding all difference, blotting out all form. So the soul is the perception of the soul, which still is a perception of multiplicity and unity, is blotted out, and we have the homogeneity of synthesis. Form is blotted out, difference is blotted out, and this is a perception of the Father aspect. So okay, so that's the Venus. That's the Venus detriment. Of course, you know, that's not how ordinary astrology interprets it. When Venus is in detriment in the ordinary sense, Venus is the planet of values, Aries is the sign of hasty action and impulse, and it is a leaping towards that which is of lesser value, a fairly undiscriminating outreach towards beauty or what you desire, and it tends to be cruder and less refined. That is the fall of beautiful, refining Venus in hasty Aries. This is the way it could be interpreted in a lesser sense, but DK, always talking about soul astrology, lets us understand Venus as the solar angel, and lets us understand what happens when soul perception, which so many of us have yet to perceive, is itself superseded. Okay, so the Father aspect, the presence, veiled by the angel of the presence, dominates the scene at the end of the greater world cycle when the monad flourishes. What is the greater world cycle? Is this the solar system itself? Is the greater world cycle the cycle of the solar system, perhaps? DK is vague about these periods of time. He speaks about eons and cycles and greater cycles and so forth. And one day, exactly what they are will be filled in. Right now, we just have some fragments, and from them, we can speculate. We are told that the incarnating minds, human beings on their own high plane, the solar angel. See, here he's kind of mixing what a solar angel and what a human being is. A human being becomes a human being because of the intervention of the solar angels. At least that's the way in our present solar system and on our present planet. There were other methods of becoming a human being on the moon chain and in the earlier solar system. But the incarnating minds are, in a way, solar angels, and they are responsible for creating the human being. That these solar angels came originally from Venus. Well, that is, DK elaborates in a treatise on cosmic fire and tells us they didn't really come from Venus, but they came under the Venusian influence. They came under the solar influence. They came under the Venusian influence. And really, they didn't come from Venus at all, but they came from the Venus chain of the Earth scheme and from the Venus globe of the Earth scheme. Now, you know, how we would look at this is as follows. Yeah, they're right there. Right there. We can look at it that way. Here is Earth scheme. Yes, there it is. And the solar angels are basically coming from the second chain, which is the Venus chain. And they're coming from the sixth or second globe, which is the Venus globe. And then they're coming down into the Earth chain, to the Venus globe of the Earth chain, until finally they arrive at our Earth globe. That is the true and more elaborated descent of the solar angels. But wherever they came from, they are certainly allied to Venus. They are Venusian beings, and their real origin is as follows: from Sirius to the heart of the sun, and some to the central spiritual sun, and thence to Venus, and perhaps Neptune is involved, and thence to the Earth and to the different parts of the Earth scheme, such as the Venus chain and the Venus globe and the Earth chain and the Earth and the Venus globe of the Earth chain and then the Earth globe of the Earth chain. So there, the line of the descent of the solar angels is pretty well mapped out, although, you know, for us that's just a model. We don't really understand how it was accomplished, how long it took, this psychic transference over vast periods, vast areas of space. We don't understand how it happens. We are told that the incarnating minds, the human beings, the solar angels. See, there he really gives an equivalence of human beings and solar angels, but it's not exactly so. But here he's not attempting to be exact. The human being comes to birth because the underlay by the solar angels. Came originally from Venus. Well, not all human beings came from Venus, but certainly the solar angels came under the Venusian impulse. But they, in turn, give place to the monad, the One. There are many monads, and yet there's only one monad. There are many apparent instantiations of spirit, many emanations, many depths of immersion of spirit along the emanative stream, as I've sometimes called it. But there's really only one. There's one monad in all of cosmos. And the divisibility of the monad is one of the great mysteries, how that occurs. And Master M calls it, the divisibility of the spirit. He calls it that. Now, does he mean this emanative divisibility? Perhaps he does. Mind gives place to the intuition. Venus is the mind, giving place to the intuition and reason, the reason of the mental plane, to pure perception. Pure perception is pure reason. So Venus is not so much connected with pure reason, even though as a planet it is Buddhic in nature and is working upon pure reason in the cosmic sense. But in the horoscope of man, it is more Mercury and Neptune, which are related to pure reason, and Venus is related to higher Manas particularly. Probably the reading of Alan Leo's Esoteric Astrology would be important. I remember I read it years and years ago, and, you know, being new to Theosophy, maybe I couldn't make so much sense out of it. It was a book written, I think, around 1917 or so, very prescient in a way, preceding the Tibetans' books by on Esoteric Astrology by at least 15 years, and bringing Theosophy into astrology. So, in a way, esoteric, yes, indeed. But it was difficult to understand at the time, and now I think having read Esoteric Astrology would be easier to understand. Now we have Saturn. It's a fall. Saturn falls in Aries. Is this good or bad? Well, it can be both. This has two meanings, for this is a dual sign. Okay, he talks about this, the signs. We have the two horns of the ram making this a dual sign. Whenever the glyph demonstrates duality, we have a dual sign with dual potentials, usually a right and a left and a higher and a lower. Things apparently going in opposite directions. First, Saturn is the lord of karma, the most powerful of the karmic lords. He kind of gives names to these karmic lords, and Saturn is maybe associated with that karmic lord called pain. I hate to digress, but here we go. You know, digression becomes almost a duty. Externalization of the hierarchy, and he has here pain, return. Okay, so this where this is found on page 117, 116. The names of the lords of karma signify symbolically from the angle of their inner meaning, relationship, enlightenment, pain, and return. So we could find lords of planets who are associated with these names, and I believe the lord of the planet Saturn is associated with pain and enlightenment, would be Mercury, and relationship would be Venus, and we will have to determine what return might mean, something cyclic, you know, something where you're retracing your steps, perhaps in spiral cyclic motion, perhaps it's Jupiter. Anyway, there are different karmic lords in our solar system, and the lords of the planets are those karmic lords. Saturn is the greatest and most powerful of the karmic lords in our solar system. There's certainly karma beyond Saturn. The Sirius is a great karmic lord. Well, the solar angel is a karmic dispenser. Our sun, our planetary logos, is a karmic lord. There are these Lipika lords and Maharajas in our solar system, which represent Sirius. Ultimately for us, Sirius is the dispenser of the Lord of Karma. So first, Saturn is the Lord of Karma, the imposer of retribution, which is the payback with a purpose of balancing, the imposer of retribution, and the one who demands full payment. Like one of my old friends says, pay in full, pay in full, painful. Okay, Saturn is pain. The one who demands full payment of all the debts in order to equilibrize, and who therefore condemns us to the struggle for existence. So Saturn is labor, it's work. It's work against the energies of the moon chain and of the previous solar system. It takes effort under Saturn to deal with those energies, to swim against the stream. So struggle for existence both from the form side and from the soul side. Saturn rules in Capricorn in two areas, both form and soul. So Saturn therefore fell when man fell into generation. And remember, Aries initiated generation, or the movement into generation and the lower worlds. He followed the sons of men down into their low place, which was an act of great mercy, actually. Saturn turns out to be a very merciful god. So that is a fall. He falls into the lower worlds in order to officiate over the conduct of the human being, so that the law may be observed and the human being may not be lost, but by the imposition of karma, man is corrected so that he may rise into his proper state and not be forever lost in the maze of the lower worlds. So there is a kind of fall there, because Aries represents generation. Aries represents the seeding process, the spreading of the seed that may grow. So there is Aries representing this descent, and Saturn falls with Aries into the lower worlds. Let's maybe put that down. Saturn falls with Aries into the lower worlds. Okay. Now there's a second way in which Saturn falls in Aries. Saturn's power is completely ended. Well, that's a big statement. Completely ended. Okay, you know, because Saturn rules the entire cosmic physical plane and is a correspondence to the permanent atom, to the cosmic permanent atom of the solar logos, cosmic physical permanent atom. So can we talk about completely ended? Okay, I don't know. But in our context, yes, completely ended. Saturn's power is completely ended as Lord of Karma, and his work accomplished when man, the spiritual man, has freed himself from karma and from the power of the two crosses. In other words, he's taken the fourth initiation. So let's just say that the usual karmic meaning of Saturn is completely ended once the fourth initiation is taken. That's what's completely ended. There are higher meanings of Saturn. It represents the divine plan. It represents, in a way, the divine purpose. It represents the entire manifestation on the cosmic physical plane. Esoterically, Saturn cannot follow man onto the cardinal cross. Well, there, you know, okay, the usual meanings of Saturn, which is karmic retribution in relation to the lower worlds, cannot follow man onto the cardinal cross, because that cross is above the level of karma in the three lower worlds. Matter of fact, it's above the level of karma in the five lower worlds, and Saturn is Brahma. He is, in a way, Brahma, and not Brahman, but Brahma, and ruler of the five lower worlds, as he officiates from the Atmic plane. Okay. So there is a fall there. Saturn cannot follow man onto the cardinal cross, and Aries is somehow introducing man to the cardinal cross, because it's a great resurrective energy. Something entirely new is happening always with Aries, and the mounting of the cardinal cross is an entirely new thing, so lower Saturn or its lower tendencies cannot follow. And yet, when it comes to the purpose of Sanat Kumara, to follow that purpose is a very Saturnian thing. So a type of higher Saturn representing a planetary logoic, okay, planetary logoic law and solar logoic law can follow man onto the cardinal cross. Okay. So, anyway, those are the two falls. Those are the two falls. Saturn falls down into the lower worlds to officiate over man's progress, and Saturn falls away as man steps onto the cardinal cross. On the cardinal, I'll put that down. Saturn falls away and cannot follow man onto the cardinal cross, at least not in Saturn's lower aspect. Okay, so let's see. There is much that could be elaborated along this line. You know, I was thinking about the book on Exaltations and Falls by Monique Pommier. Monique, please forgive me. I'm not remembering the name of your book, but it's a wonderful book and exquisitely described. These rulerships, falls and exaltations, exquisitely described. So I would recommend to anyone, I'll try to find the name of the book, by Monique Pommier, to read the processes described with great finesse. Oh, my goodness, look what I've done. Yak, yak, yak. All right, we... oh, goodness. On a roll, huh? But I've rolled right beyond our time limit. So anyway, this is Esoteric Astrology 48. And we've gone from one page to another. I guess we've gone from page 103 to 105, which is the usual two pages, I guess. Okay, from page 103 to 105. And we will continue with Esoteric Astrology 49 next. We will now, together, as we usually do, do the great invocation. Okay. As it's the most important mantra we have to prepare humanity for the reappearance of the Christ, which is really amounting to the salvation of humanity. So it's our most effective instrument in doing that, and that's why we work on it and always remind ourselves to use the great invocation with intent. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men, let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men, may Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Okay, friends, we have finished number 48. And we will move into 49, still continuing with Aries. We are working now on the falls and exaltations, the different types of planets that have different status in the sign Aries. So, until that time, we'll see you. Looking forward to the next. Bye-bye.